It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Goodison Park.
Well, everybody, welcome to the latest edition of Goodison Park, my home. And it's a real pleasure to welcome a longtime friend of mine, Dr. David France, to the studio today. It's a real change of pace for us today. Whereas the series will always predominantly be about former players, players like managers and club directors come and go, but it's the fans with the lifeblood of Everton Football Club. And Dr. David France, oh boy, he doesn't mind me calling him an Everton super fan from his home in North America. So David France was the founder and driving force of numerous initiatives related to Everton Football Club, the Gladys Street Hall of Fame since 1996, the Everton Former Players Foundation since 1999, the Everton Heritage Society since 2008, and the Everton Collection since 2007, which was the greatest one-club collection of memorabilia in the entire football world. The Everton War Memorial since 2011. He's also authored 19 Everton books since 1997, with proceeds donated to Merseyside charities. Liverpool's Freedom of the City panel rewarded him with the prestigious title of Citizen of Honour in 2011, first person to receive it for services to Merseyside football since a certain Bill Shankly. The following year received an OBE for services to football in the United Kingdom and Europe, and he's the life president of the Everton Shareholders Association. So welcome, David, Dr. Everton. Evertonian extraordinaire.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I couldn't have written it better myself. It's great to be back on Merseyside, where the weather is terrible, but the people are lovely.
Yeah, a stark contrast from his usual base in Arizona. But, I mean, it started in Widnes just after the Second World War there. You were never too enamoured with the oval ball, the calling, as you call it in your autobiography, of Mama Blue. And Goodison Park was there from an early age, several generations of Evertonians in the France family, and it was always the way for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm a fifth generation Evertonian. One of my relatives who came from Runcorn,
yeah,
he owned three of the original shares. So we go back quite a way. It was handed down like an heirloom from one member of the family generation to the next. My mum was a Geordie, so she converted to being an Evertonian, but my dad and his brother's grandfather, they were diehard Evertonians.
Yeah.
I was indoctrinated by my grandfather, who was a lifeblood Evertonian, and he told me tales of Dixie Dean, Tommy Lawton, Warnie Creswell, Joe Mercer, and because both of my parents worked in Widnes, I spent a lot of time after school as a tot, going with my grandparents. And this was in the days of food rationing, just after the war. And he had an allotment where he kept chickens.
Yeah.
There's a reason for me telling you this story.
Oh, it says.
And he made the mistake of naming these chickens. So there was Warner Creswell, there was Ted Sager, there was Joe Mercer, etc. Yeah. And my grandmother wasn't a keen Evertonian.
Okay.
Actually, she wasn't the nicest as a person. And I'll explain this to you, because one lunchtime I was having my lunch with them, and she'd made some soup.
Yeah.
And she said to me, "David, how's the soup?" And I said, "It's smashing, Grandma." And she said, "You do realise you're eating Dixie Dean."
Wow. Of all of them to give you Dixie
so
as well.
She was quite a cruel son, so.
And from an early age, though, you've still got those vivid memories of that first visit to Goodison Park, and even the colours that it brought.
Yeah, I was a sick kid.
Yeah.
And a poorly sick kid. I'd been in isolation hospital in St Helens, which is... You know, it's a painful experience for anybody from Widnes. I was a sick kid, a small kid, and I was regarded as being a bit slow. I was treated as being a bit slow. A nice lad, but he's, you know, our Dave's a bit slow. And so my mother, my father wanted me to go to Goodison at a very early age, but my mother stopped that. I think she wanted me to have a happy childhood. And so it was 9 by the time I'd got out of the isolation hospital, and my mum had agreed for my dad to take me to Goodison. We were born, and I tell everybody this, as you may know, we were raised in a slum, you know, with one light bulb and one cold tap. And I'm not playing the violin here. Yeah. A lot of people listening to this of the bald age of 70 will know that that's what life was like back then.
Yeah.
But my dad somehow had got a car.
Yeah.
I don't know where it came from. It was of mysterious provenance. And he took me in this car to Goodison.
Yeah.
And we parked by the Arkles pub near Anfield. Yeah. He wanted to show me Anfield as well. And my dad was a labourer. Big strapping fella. He was a boxer come semi-professional footballer.
Yeah.
And he carried a milk crate, a galvanised metal milk crate, and we walked across Stanley Park.
Yeah.
And as we got closer and closer, he got excited, and of course I got excited, you know. And as we reached Goodison, it was in the days before the floodlights were in place, the pylons were in place, but they hadn't been switched on yet.
Oh, right.
They hadn't been commissioned. That was the following week. It was a midweek game against Manchester United. Yes. I think it was something like a 6:15 kickoff, so it was an unusual time.
Yeah.
And it was like 73,000 people there packed in Goodison, and he took me into the paddock. You know, he threatened to take me into the boys' pen, but that's a different story. But he took me into the paddock because I was such a small kid, and he put the milk crate against the wall, and so I could look over it.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, you get this great sense. I get this every time I go to Goodison. It's just this magical, kind of biblical place. You know, my first memories of it is that they had a church in the corner.
Of course.
And my dad said that's because God likes to keep an eye on his favourite team.
Yeah.
I mean, I was brainwashed as a kid. And these pylons, they punctured the heavens.
Yeah.
And in those days, they had the four stands, had the crisscross.
Yeah, Archibald Leach,
the balconies on them. So it was magical. And I said there were 70,000 people in there. But what amazed me the most is the grass. You know, I was from Widnes. We didn't have grass. You know, we were polluted you know, in the chemical industry in the 50s. And, you know, I can't tell you where the nearest grass was to our house. Yeah. We lived in the centre of the town. It must have been a mile away.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't familiar. When we played rugby league, we played on cinders.
Yeah.
You know, so we didn't have grass in school. And I just overwhelmed by this manicured grass and the white lines and everything. But as I said, it was like a religious experience. I remember the smells of Brill Cream and Woodbine cigarettes.
Yeah.
You know, it was like you could make some religious connection with that. You know? There was no chanting. There was no singing in those days. Yeah. It was just the great oohs and ahs of being at a football match. Yeah. But there was something that I always remember is that as the ground got filled, people were being passed overhead like some kind of sacrifice.
Yeah.
And I also remember that on the other side of the wall, the perimeter wall, they had the numbers for the halftime score.
Yeah.
And they ran out of numbers after the Z, and they went to hearts, diamonds, etc. Yeah. And I thought that was some kind of message from some spiritual message or whatever. It was 3-3. The game was 3-3 against the Busby Babes. They were the champions of England. A few months later, they perished at Munich. And I have to say, every kid in Widnes knew the names of the Manchester United team. And if you're going to test me now, I'll impress you with my short-term memory. it was... Woods was in goal. Bill Foulkes and Roger Byrne, who was the captain of England, of England as well. There was Eddie Coleman, Jackie Blanchflower, who was Danny Blanchflower's brother. He finished in a wheelchair after the Munich. The great Duncan Edwards, who of course perished there. There was John Berry, who was a winger for England. Liam Whelan, Tommy Taylor, who was the goal scorer, Dennis Violet and David Pegg. And all kids knew that. The Everton team was just a mixture of local lads and whether, you know, the Tansies and the Dunlops and the Jones and the Harrises, Fielding, Dave Hickson and Derek Temple. And Derek scored twice that game.
Young Derek Temple.
For a period in my life, I've told this Derek many times, he was my hero. But it didn't last long. It did resurge as my hero in 1966. But he was my hero at my first game.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
I mean, as you mentioned there, as great an Evertonian as ever was, Dave Hickson, I guess he must have stood out there. I mean,
he did. He scored
just his blonde hair.
He scored the winner. I'm saying it finished 3-3, but he scored the winner in the days before VAR. And it was disallowed because I think he'd punched someone on the way to heading the ball.
Even then, wouldn't
so it was this
that.
Great sigh. You know, we were 3-1 down at half time. We fought back to 3-3 and we had a goal disallowed towards the end.
Yeah. So it lived up to all your expectations. You said you've been indoctrinated from an early age, but
it was this wonderful experience. And what I enjoyed, I think, equally as much as it, on the way back, my dad spoke to me because he didn't really, in those days, fathers didn't spend much time with the kids. And it was about the only thing we'd ever connected on. And I thought, this is great, you know, going to the match with your dad and him talking about the match with you and listening to you. I thought that was very special. I didn't go to the match many times with him on my own. And we went later on in my life. We went as a family with my uncles and my mother, etc. But I didn't go to the match. It sounds very unusual. I didn't go to the match very much on my own. I think I was just a disappointment to them.
Wow. If only he knew. But we moved on. We're going to focus on certain games, which are big, momentous occasions in Everton's history and your watching of Everton. We move on to a very different era now. The 50s were a tough time for Everton, but come the 60s, they had the backing of John Moores, of course, and spending big. The Mersey Millionaires, as incredible as that might seem now to younger generations, and it's a game towards the earlier part of that period. Even back then, dirty Leeds, as it were, Leeds United. The players were actually, for those younger ones who might not be aware of this, the players were actually taken off the pitch to calm down by the referee. Such were tempers were fraying. You wanted to mention this as one of your great games at Goodison.
Yeah, it was a memorable game, wasn't it? It's a great game. You know, you've got to remember, during that time, we'd got Bobby Collins had come in from Scotland. He'd revolutionised the team. We'd got Roy Vernon, Tommy Ring, Jimmy Gabriel. Alex Young has arrived. We'd won the title. The year before, I think we'd won the title. Come 64, Leeds had been promoted that season. I think they had been promoted that season, and we'd played them in the cup and that had been somewhat of an industrial game. And they arrived at Goodison full of evil. Yeah. I mean, you can name the names, and I mean, I'm sure they're out there really nice guys that are good to the mothers, but you know, you had Billy Bremner, Norman Hunter, Jack Charlton, Peter Lorimer, Johnny Giles was no saint, and of course he had Bobby Collins.
Yeah, little Bobby was playing for them by
who
this
we'd
point,
let
yeah.
go.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the biggest mistakes that Harry Catherick made.
Yeah.
He left Everton to become Footballer of the Year.
Yeah.
And of course we were no angels. Our hard man, Tony Kaye, didn't play in that game, but we still had Jimmy Gabriel and Roy Vernon and Dennis Stevens and others that are better not named, who weren't shy. And I remember most about the game. It was games in the 60s. They weren't that greatly attended. I think there'd only be about 45,000 there. Right. From the era of, I mentioned before, yeah. when you had the 60s, 70,000s, I think football was losing a bit of its appeal at that time. And Leeds showed up, and we'd only been playing 2-3 minutes, and Sandy Brown got sent off.
Yeah.
Johnny Giles, who had been a wonderful, skillful winger at Manchester United, but he went to Leeds and, you know, I think they taught him how to go over the ball.
Yeah.
And he put his studs up onto Brown's chest and ripped his shirt open. Yeah. So Sandy just thumped him. And I mean, he poleaxed him. Yeah. We thought, you know, the sled's going to be carried off. And years later, I'd said to Sandy, and we know through the Former Players Foundation, I got to know many of these people. Yeah. And I said to Sandy, what was that about?
Yeah.
3 minutes into the game? And he said, well, he said my parents weren't married.
Right.
So yeah. So to Sandy, that was the greatest insult.
Yeah.
So Sandy got sent off. We played for about half an hour with 10 men.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing went crazy. With tattles. I mean, I think we were as bad as Leeds.
Yeah.
The tattles were savage. It was one after another. There was no continuity to the game. It was one nasty foul after another. And then I think in about the 35th minute, the fullback who actually had scored for Leeds, which turned out to be the winner, called Willie Bell, he tackled, I think he'd done a Cantona kung fu kick on Derek Temple.
Right.
And they took Derek off on a stretcher, and they sort of Leeds, you know, a bit of professionalism, they carried their guy off, you know, with his arms around the trainer's neck type of thing. And the referee just took them off. And you see that great picture of Brian LeBone, who's at 6'2", 6'3",
yeah.
little Bobby Collins, 5'3".
Yeah.
And behind them are all these naughty boys. They look like, you know, they pushed the referee too far.
Yeah.
So he just took them all off.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
We thought the game was going to be abandoned, you know, and as it was, they had a 10-minute cooling off period,
yeah.
which didn't work, and then they brought them back on, and they just carried on.
Yeah,
it was just a battle. It was a disgrace to football, and it was a disgrace to the Everton side, who were a really quality footballing team. And as you know, Leeds could play football,
yeah, of course.
as they showed, you know, a few years later.
Yeah,
but it was one of those terrible days.
Yeah.
So that's obviously etched in my memory.
Yeah. Before we move on to your next game, I've got to ask you about some of those players from the 60s. I mean, Alex Young, you were very close to him.
I was a very good friend of Alex, yeah.
Just what was it that, I mean, maybe supporters of other clubs don't sort of understand it, the feeling that he had from the Evertonians and why that was and what it was as him as a footballer. Because if you've not seen him play, and it's of course Harry Catterick sort of shunned the limelight, he didn't like the cameras coming to Goodison. So there's not a lot of footage of him. Just what was it about Alex Young?
I always say when it comes to Everton, when it comes to Goodison, there were two gods of Goodison that I know of from my indoctrination. There was Dixie Dean, who was the god of goals.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Alex Young, the god of skills.
Yeah.
Dixie Dean is remembered by the number of times he put the ball in the net.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Young is remembered by the number of times he took our breath away.
Yeah.
He was sensational. His ability, skills were unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
He'd do things in a match that people wouldn't even attempt in training. And I have to say that I made a film called Alex the Great, about a documentary about Alex, which I always think that we always pay tribute to people after they pass away.
Yeah.
And I wanted Alex to feel what the the love that the fans had for him just before he died. Yes. So we made this film. We showed it in Liverpool, in Goodison. We showed it in London. And luckily, Alex got to come to it.
Yeah.
And in the film, I think one of the greatest tributes is made by Ron Yates,
yeah,
and the captain of Liverpool, who said that he was the best centre forward of, you know, of Ron Yates's era,
yeah,
in Britain. You know, he was so talented. Yeah. He was graceful. He was elegant. He would have graced any era. Mm. You know, his level of skill level would have been, you know, it was, it would have fitted into any era. Mm. Now, you know, people think, well, you know, he was 5'6" or something, blonde hair, whatever. You know, not the most muscular of guys, yeah, but he worked down the pit. He, yeah, served in the army. You know, he was a tough lad.
Yeah.
You know, in those days, players like Young, I'm trying to think, the equivalent is it would have been at Liverpool, but players like Young, they had protection. They always had a minder. And Jimmy Gabriel was Alex Young's minder. So if anybody smacked Young, they knew what was coming from Jimmy Gabriel.
Yeah.
That's how it was back then.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
And of course, the Holy Trinity, Harvey, Kendall, Ball. I mean,
yeah,
I think it was when your book on the Holy Trinity, I think that we first met, we first.
I think we did do. No, that, I think we one, did yeah. do. Becky Tallentine and I, yeah, wrote the Holy Trinity, and we got the opportunity to interview everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone who played with them. Of course, we did with Alan and Howard and Colin. And then we interviewed the fans of my era and also younger eras who had heard it, you know, the talk being passed down. When it came to the Holy Trinity, they just dominated games. But I'd like to mention someone who never gets the credit, which is Colin Harvey. Colin Harvey was an outstanding footballer and, of course, a local lad. He oozed grace, and because he had a bit of a niggle about him as well.
Yeah.
But he could play, Colin. Mm-hmm. He really could.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very sad that, you know, he had all sorts of injuries.
Yeah.
You know, he had eye optic injuries and he had hip injury. But he was a tremendous footballer and, of course, a tremendous Evertonian.
Yeah.
But can I just go back a little bit about, so I can, maybe I should caution your viewers here.
Yeah.
What not to do. When I went to my first game when I was 9, my dad, we moved from the slum up to the council houses, which was fantastic because we had a garden.
Yeah.
And we were near the railway station. So my dad let me go on my own to the home games.
Okay.
So I'd go from Widnes to Liverpool Central Station on my own. I'd meet people. There weren't many Evertonians in Widnes.
Yeah.
There were no Coppites in Liverpool. No offence to anyone.
Yeah.
Sorry, of course, there was a reason for that, was they were in the second division at the time and it wasn't that.
Yeah.
Maybe they were there, but they didn't. It didn't make much noise. And I would go and I'd go with whoever was on the platform at the station. We just went along. So I went in all different parts of the ground. And then when I was 12, my parents allowed me to go to away games on my own. So most of the away games I went to were, of course, there were a lot of Lancashire teams in the first division at that time, the Blackburns, the Burnleys, the Prestons, the Blackpools. There were lots of them. And so I'd come into Liverpool, get the train normally from Exchange to go to those places, or I'd get the train to Manchester from Widnes. But also more difficult places to get to. I'd go to Speke. I get the Croswell to Speke.
Yeah.
I get the Home James was the name of the coach firm.
Oh, right.
It took us from the Speke Dunlop factory to where it was. When I got to 14, I decided I'd make a career of hitchhiking.
Wow. Yeah.
And you've heard this.
I know where this one's going.
You know where this is going. So I was hitchhiking.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is in Widnes, it's a transportation hub. It still is.
Yeah.
From the chemical industry then was vibrant. Yeah. The whole town was chemicals, and there were all these trucks taking these chemicals to different parts of the country.
Yeah.
And so we had come up with a plan. I had a friend called Tommy, who was a little bit older than me, and my mother didn't like him because he smoked.
Okay.
Right. He was a bad influence, was Tommy. Yeah. And we'd catch the bus to the Bold Transport Cafe, which is on the way to Warrington.
Okay.
And that's where the drivers of these wagons full of chemicals would stop and have the breakfast before they set off on the journeys. And you've got to remember, at that time, there wasn't necessarily the motorway system that we have now.
No.
So a lot of it was A-roads. There were some motorways, but it wasn't...
Yeah, the trunk roads.
Yeah, there was the M6 was in place. So we'd go to the transport cafe, and Tommy would send me in. I was a 14-year-old little squirt, you know, who I should say at that time couldn't read. I was slow and I hadn't learned to read at that time. So I went into this transport cafe and I'd go in and all the guys were there and I'd say, I'm going to Leicester. I'm going to watch Everton at Leicester. Anybody want to give me a lift? And, you know, they'd look up from their full English breakfast and, you know, look down again and ignore me. So I'd go out, and then Tommy would say, come back in and charm them. So he'd send me back in, and I'd go back in and said, I don't know if you heard me, but I'm going to Leicester to watch Everton play Leicester. And if you give me a lift, I promise to listen to your boring stories about your wife, your kids, and your dog. And it worked every time.
Yeah.
And after a while, we sort of had a little group of drivers who would look after us.
Okay.
I mean, it really was. They were looking after us. And the thing about trucks was getting lifts off trucks was they had radios and heaters, which were optional extras in cars in those
very
days.
Very luxurious.
So we'd go everywhere.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to get you to the story, your favourite story. And hopefully people are still hanging in on this.
Yeah.
So one time we didn't get the lift down to where we were hopefully going, and we got dropped off on the M6 at Knutsford.
Yeah.
And on the access road, and we were thumbing. And I've told you this before. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a magical digit. It can make the body move at 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Because, you know, hitchhiking is, it teaches you how to judge people.
Yeah.
It teaches you how to deal with the disappointment, rejection, because you get all these people who pass you and ignore you. And anyway, we were hitchhiking and this guy shows up in the Triumph Herald. Funny how you remember these things.
Yeah.
There's a good reason why. It was a two-tone Triumph Herald, four-door. He stopped. We looked at him, made our quick assessment of whether he was safe to get in the car with. He had very strong, thick glasses. He wore a sports coat with leather patches. He looked like a school teacher. Yeah. And he had on his hands, he had these calf skin, very smooth leather gloves, you know, driving gloves with holes in around the knuckles. Yeah. So we got in. Great, where are you going? We're going to Stoke. We're going to Stoke on this occasion. The old Victoria Ground. Get in, he said. And we'd been going about 5 minutes. You know what happens next. He takes one of his gloves off. He undoes his fly and he starts playing with himself. Well, we didn't know what to say. You know, we were giggling like daft lads. And my friend Tommy, who was sat at the front, said, oh, put that away, you're frightening the traffic. Which I thought was a great thing for a 15-year-old to say. Which point the guy hit the brakes and bundles out of the car like two unwanted puppies on the side of the M6.
Yeah.
So now we're stuck on the M6. And as you know, drivers can't stop in England on the motorway.
No.
As my mum said, but they can slow down and give you false hope. You know? So we were there stranded on the M6, you know, halfway towards the Knutsford services.
Yeah.
And of course, what shows up next is the police. Two big bobbies in one of these lovely Jaguars that you see in the Morse TV programs. Yeah. Absolutely wonderful car. And he gets, you know, he's, what, get in, you two, you know, where the hell are you going? So we get in the car and they were, you know, really kind to us. And we'd set off. And about 10 minutes later, they said to us, what are you doing here? Tell us a story while you're there. And we did do. And it was shocked. And they said, you know, what did he look like, the driver? And my friend said, Tommy said, about 4 inches uncircumcised.
Wow. There's a cautionary tale for all away days.
I must add that I've had that word cleared by the people at the Echo.
Yeah, we've got the approval of that. But moving swiftly on from Dr. Francis' most notorious tales, and a more happy occasion, the Borussia Mönchengladbach European Cup. Bizarrely, Everton led the way when it came to winning penalty shootouts.
They did indeed. I remember it well. We were champions. I was living in Manchester at the time, and I was hitchhiking to home games. I didn't go to many away games then because I just didn't have the funds to do it. And the deal of hitchhiking to Goodison from Manchester, it was a two-step approach.
Yeah.
You got to the Haydock roundabout.
Yeah.
If you could get to the Haydock roundabout, it was easy because you got all the traffic coming off the M6, and if you got your scarf on, they're always going to pick you up.
Yeah.
You know, getting back, maybe a little bit more difficult, but yet to get to the Haydock roundabout. So I'd gone this night, and it was sensational. We'd drawn 1-1 over there. Howard Kendall scored a cracking goal, and we came back, and John Morrissey scored in the first or second minute. A bit of a fluke. It was a centre. John may not agree with this, but it would seem like a floated centre cross, and everyone left it. Joe went to head it, but he moved his head back, Joe Rao, and it crept in.
Yeah.
They unfortunately equalised towards the end. They were a good team, as all German teams were. Yeah. They had Bertie Voigt, I don't know if you remember. He was the captain at the time. And it went to this, we'd never seen it before, penalty shootout. And what I remember most about it is we didn't know how it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd never seen it before. We didn't know how it worked and whatever. And I think somebody had to describe it to us, you know, over the intercom, the public address system, that, you know, there would be five penalties each and whatever.
Yeah.
And Gordon West didn't play in the game. You know, he was our first team goalkeeper, but Gordon had dips in form. And he'd been replaced at this time by Andy Rankin, who was a local lad from Bootle. Lovely and agile goalkeeper. Lovely lad. A bit small compared to today's standards, but a bit small, light. But what he lacked in height, he made up in agility.
Yeah.
So I'll walk you through it. The game finishes. They're all gathered in the centre circle. Gordon West has come on to the pitch. He's in his blue tracksuit.
Yeah.
And Gordon was the character in the dressing room. Yeah. You know, he laid down the law. Yeah. He was the discipline in the dressing room. He would discipline people. He would put people in the place and tell them how to, you know, to conduct themselves professionally with younger people or people who were a bit big-headed in a way. And they all gathered in the centre circle, and Joe was the first one up to take the penalty. Joe could hit a ball, and he hit it right down the middle. Unfortunately, the goalkeeper didn't move.
Yeah.
And he went straight into the goalkeeper's chest, which was a big blow and for everyone, including Joe. And then the Germans scored a couple. Our lads was, I think it was John Morrissey, Howard Kendall, Alan Ball. And I have to say to all the Alan Ball fans, he wasn't the greatest penalty taker.
He missed a few.
He had missed a few. John Morrissey was excellent. Howard produced a cracker. And then the German missed. The German slid one just on the wrong side of the post. So we were level going into the last two penalties. Up came Sandy Brown. Now, Sandy had this rocket of a shot. Not necessarily, he didn't know what direction it was going to go in, but he could hit this ball hard. I think it was the Daily Mirror had done a competition around that time to find the hardest kicker of a football in the country. And Brown had come second to Peter Lorimer of Leeds, who, you know, he had two Scotsmen. Anyway, while Sandy's preparing preparing his thunderbolt, his rocket to go into the back of the net, Gordon West approached Andy Rankin to give him some advice, given the fact that Gordon was playing for England. Yeah. And he said, the next guy up is this defender called Müller from Russian background. And he said, I've watched him, I've studied him, I've researched him. He said, I've done my homework. He said, he's light-footed and he's going to open his body and he's going to go to your left. So Andy, dive early to the left. So and the Sandy Brown smacks the ball in the net. So we're now one ahead. And this poor guy, Mueller, the defender, goes up, you know, hits the ball, and he goes to the right, goes early to the right and saves it. And afterwards, Gordon approached Andy and said, "Oh, good job. Nobody listens to my advice."
Wow. Because I remember reading a report from the time, from the Echo, and they said, "Oh, well, old timers say that the Everton 6 Sunderland 4 Cup replay was the greatest game at Goodison." And they were saying, they said that must have been a great game because this would rival it. And like you say, just beating the Germans on penalties.
But we'd never seen anything like it before. We didn't know what happened, what would have happened after the five penalties taken each, and we didn't know about it. They just continue. Anyway, we went through, and of course we got knocked out by Paris and I, because we had a bad day.
Yeah.
A bad day in Goodison, a bad day in Greece. So maybe people say we were robbed in Greece, but I don't know. We messed it up in Goodison.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
See, a fallow period. I mean, it seems relatively short by contemporary standards of 14 years without a trophy. But then obviously the mid-80s were a great time to be an Evertonian again. But the circumstances have changed a lot from you. You're talking about hitchhiking from Manchester. By this time, you're working. Is it? You're already working in the oil industry in the USA?
I'd left school. I'd struggled to read until I was 14.
Yeah.
I just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And I'd gone secondary modern school and I was enjoyed school.
Yeah.
And I left school at 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that many jobs for the likes of me. And so I got an apprenticeship as a gas fitter.
Yeah.
It was changed my life. And this gas board encouraged me to go to tech college. Now I could read. The world had opened up to me.
Yeah.
And whilst the rest of the lads, they went to tech college, you know, they got one day a week type of thing, and they sort of skived off or didn't take it serious. I studied, and I went to tech college in Birkenhead, in Riversdale, in Aigburth, and in St Helens, and I did so well that the gas board said, "Well, you know, we'd like to send you to the Royal College of Advanced Technology," which sounds very prestigious. But the day I got there, it changed its name to the University of Salford.
Okay.
So I went to Salford, which is great.
Yeah.
And I struggled, as you'd imagine. I didn't have the background that these lads from grammar schools and public schools, that they all had. I struggled, but I put my head down. I wasn't a drinker, so I didn't go out. I went out socialised, but in those days, there was a lot of drinking went on at university. So I studied. And I did very well. I finished up with 4 degrees.
Yeah.
I was educated in three different countries, in Britain, in Germany, and in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I finished up the PhD. And I always think, people always say to me, why do you use the courtesy title doctor? Mm-hmm. Well, if you come from a slum in Widnes where you only have one light bulb, I think you're allowed to call yourself doctor.
Yeah.
And my mum used to say, my son's a doctor, but not the type that helps people.
Okay. But you were high flyer in Houston by this
point. Oh, I did. I went to the university in Purdue in Indiana.
Yeah.
And I got about 8 scholarships, about 6 different medals from my research.
Yeah.
I never thought of myself as a scientist. It was just, I think I was a better scientist than I was a gas fitter.
Yeah.
You know, with no disrespect to the people in Widnes, I wasn't very good at the gas fitting. But then when I left, I got an MBA at Purdue and I had to come back to UK as a part of the scholarship that I got. Yeah. And I was approached by Senator Edward Kennedy to move to the United States, which I was appreciative of. And I worked for his people in the nuclear and the NASA, and for NASA.
Yeah.
And the nuclear business at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which was a secretive lab where they made weapons. And then after I'd served my 2 years for them, I was headhunted by an oil company.
Yeah.
I was 32. But between that, I'd got married.
Yeah.
From a lovely lady, as I've said once on the BBC, the most decent person I've ever met. yeah. lovely lady, and she's not with me at the moment because she's very ill. But she had the intervention when we got married, which was, I'm not going to stop you watching Everton.
Yeah.
You know, I dread to think, you know, that's a part of your DNA. But she said, you were a slow learner for 14 years. You were a fast learner for 14 years. You've got to retire when you're 42 and do something more worthwhile with your life than work. Because I'm a workaholic. I throw myself into things that I have, very high standards and what I like to do. So that was the deal when she married me.
Yeah.
That was it's called the Malta Protocol. It was the intervention on our honeymoon. And okay. She seriously said that's the deal, you know. So that's what I did. I worked, I was an executive in our company in Houston. A tremendous experience for a lad from Widnes.
Yeah.
I was 25 years younger than anybody else on the executive. Yeah. And they gave me some advice, which was I had to buy an expensive suit.
Yeah.
And I had to grow a mustache, and I hate to say it, but I looked like a porn star from the 70s with this bloody mustache.
Well, we had Derek Mountfield in the other week, so you probably looked like him.
I think I was more like Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
I'd look like that or a prison inmate from Colorado or something.
Okay.
Like that. And that's how I looked for all those years.
Yeah.
I had to look older to fit in.
Yeah.
And they gave me, the young guy, the young one on the executive, they give you all these responsibilities. I had companies that I looked after, operating companies, chemicals, obviously, chemicals, uranium and nuclear and copper mining. And then I had worldwide responsibilities, which include everything, profit improvement, strategic planning, environmental affairs, business development, the whole thing worldwide. So that gave me the opportunity to visit the UK on a regular basis, which I would do at least once a month, work reasons. This is while I was working, and it worked out pretty good. I had my season ticket.
Yeah,
I could pop over. Hopefully, with the home games, but sometimes I took in the, it had to be the away games, or if I stayed for more than a few games, a few days, I could get both in. Yeah. So on a Friday, I would leave Houston on a Friday, and I'd go and see my mum. Drive up to without problem. But the only problem I had one time was it hurts, rental car, and the only car that they had was red.
Wow!
And I refused to take it.
So that was a non-starter.
They upgrade. Well, they didn't upgrade me. Upgraded me to this kind of truck type thing.
Truck instead.
His van type of thing.
Yeah,
but I couldn't show up. I couldn't show up at Goodison in a red car. And I did that on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was the time. It was easy to be an Evertonian.
Yeah.
It was easy to be an Evertonian in the 60s. But you got the likes of Alex Young and Bobby Collins, Alan Ball, Colin Harvey. And then in the 70s, it wasn't that difficult, although Liverpool were coming on extremely strong.
Yeah.
But I'd emigrated by then, so I didn't have that much of that. But we had the Bob Latchfords and the likes. And then, of course, in the 80s, Howard and Colin had put the team together.
Yeah.
And it was a smashing time to be an Evertonian.
Yeah.
When I think that now, and with respect to this century, how difficult it must be for young kids.
Yes.
I really take my hat off to them. I take my hat off to the lads who go to the away fixtures.
Yeah,
and the dedication. I mean, I've travelled 2 million miles following Everton.
Yeah,
right. But I take my hat off to those lads.
Yeah,
who travel a couple of hundred miles on a wet whatever night,
and they've only ever known
ever known disappointment.
Yeah,
or confusion or drama.
Yeah. Richard, but on a bright note, which takes us to your penultimate match, which is the Sunderland one. It's towards the end of the 84-85 season. It's the game you really believed that Everton were really onto something at this point.
Yeah, this game happened. It's not a significant game in the eyes of most people, except maybe for the goals that were scored. Some of the three finest goals that I've seen at Goodison. And I think the greatest pass I've ever seen at Goodison.
Oh, brave.
It was just before the Bayern. I think it was between the Bayern Munich games.
Yeah.
I think we'd drawn in Bayern Munich, and it was just the week before the famous tie. But we played Sunderland, and we went down 1-0, and the lads came back, and the quality of the goals was outstanding. You must look at it.
Yeah, the
YouTube.
Diving header in front of Glenn Street,
I can picture Peter Reid, going that, bombing down the wing, Peter smashing football, crossing it over, and Andy Gray getting his head to it in, I guess, the Dixie Dean kind of fashion.
Yeah.
Just incredible goal. He scored another one like it shortly afterwards.
Yeah.
And then the third goal that we all talk about is Trevor Stevens' goal, where the ball comes out. Derek Mountfield plays it out to Paul Bracewell, who doesn't even look. It's one of these no-look balls. He's got his face in his own goal, and he hits it 50 yards into the path of Trevor Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a remarkable pass. And I'd asked Paul about that, and he said, oh, we practiced it in training. It was just, he knew it was coming up.
Yeah.
And, of course, Trevor Stevens just cracked it into the net.
Yeah.
And I looked then at that game, when you've seen something special. And on my way back, I would have been back to my mother's that day, that night. I just thought to myself, this is a proper team.
Yeah,
this is up there with the whole of Trinity and the Golden Vision. These lads are going to be champions.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
I mean, with your work, with the Gladys Street Hall of Fame and all the dinners and stuff, they certainly get the appreciation for you, and Evertonians give them the love. But with the film Howard's Way, perhaps sort of showing the appreciation, I just wonder whether fans of other clubs sort of give them the kudos they deserve, that particular team, because they don't tend to be talked about amongst non-Evertonians in a way that perhaps they should be, perhaps because of events with history and what happened, and they didn't go on to win the European Cup because they weren't given the chance. But just something, what an incredible team that was.
Yeah, but I think, though, it's... and I would say the same about many other clubs. They don't get the recognition.
Yeah.
There are certain clubs that get more than the dessert. It always gets me. I used to have the famous number plate.
Yeah.
Which, can I mention that?
Yeah, you can mention the number plate. You mentioned the number plate.
I had two number plates in Arizona. One is EFC 1878 and one was H8LFC.
Yeah.
Which caused quite a stir. And I would get all these people from... Visitors from the United Kingdom would come and, smash on the horn and would give me the thumbs up, etc. And that was until the authorities took it away from me.
Right. Yeah.
But I remember this coming from a guy from Tottenham. He stopped me at the traffic lights and, put it well down his window and said, whatever. And he said he supported Tottenham. And I hate to say it, but I never think of them as anything. Yeah. I don't know when. I mean, they won the league in the 60s. Early 60s,
they did the double
with Danny Blanchard and Dave Mackay, but they've never won anything.
Yeah,
but then the players are always have always been in the media. They've always been highlighted. Whereas people don't know who Alex Young is. They don't know who Colin Harvey is. I doubt if they know who Graham Sharp is.
Yeah, yeah.
We just, that's just the nature of it. We're not. A media favourite and never have been, which is fine.
Yeah,
As long as our love for the club is as much as any. I don't think any football fans love the club as much as we love it.
Yeah.
Of course, everyone loves their own clubs and everyone thinks their own clubs are special.
Yeah, which takes us to a very poignant final choice from yourself. It's around that same time, November 85, the Arsenal game. And as your mother and reading your autobiography, Mark Carsley, was it? You refer to in that one, a more modern day reference. But you want to explain that one?
I told Lee Carsley this, that I name everyone in my book has a name.
Yeah.
Right. And I called my mother, who was a Geordie, who, when she got excited, sounded like Paul Gascoigne, and you couldn't understand the word she said, which was a good thing.
Yeah.
I told Lee Carsley that I called my mother in the book Mark Carsley because he wasn't fully appreciated while he was there,
yeah,
but he could never be replaced.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's true about Lee. Nobody really understood how good he was in as a defensive midfielder. Yeah. We may remember his goal against Liverpool, and, you know, but even then he was buried under a pile of players.
Yeah, he was actually pyramid, on that picture, was he? Was underneath.
You never saw him, and Tim Cahill took the credit for it, didn't he? So, my mother, my dad, she had a stroke in the 80s, and my dad left her, which is very sad. And so when you've been away from home, the bonds you have with your mother, et cetera, get even stronger. She wrote to me every week. I wrote to her every week. Her letter was the same letter every week. My mum comes from near Pensher Monument up. As she always says, she comes from the same place as Brian Robson and Colin Todd.
Okay.
Chesterley Street.
Yeah. Right?
But near there is Pensher Monument, which is a folly, a replica of the Pantheon in Greece.
Right.
In Athens. So she wanted to go and see the real one.
Yeah.
So off we go to do that, right? Oh, it gets better.
Yeah.
Right.
Sean Dyche was infamously underwhelmed when he went there.
Like really?
Grand Canyon, which is by you, but yeah.
She wanted to go to Acapulco and listen to the mariachi band.
Yeah.
She wanted to paddle in the Pacific Ocean. This is a little lady from, you know, she worked in the laundry. She'd got all these things that she wanted to do. I'd like to go to the Empire State Building. Right. So we did them all. I mean, we did all these things.
Did she travel much before this?
She'd gone to Spain and she'd done those things. But no, she hadn't done. Yeah. And these are things that she'd longed to do. She wanted to go stay at the Savoy Hotel.
Yeah.
Smashing. I mean, she caused a nuisance at the Savoy Hotel because she was in the room and they have all buttons around the wall, you know, like they used to have in pubs. You know, you can press the button and the valet comes and whatever. And when I got back to the hotel, the concierge, the manager, came to me and said, "Can you tell your mother to stop pressing the buttons? She's driving everybody crazy."
Yeah.
And this little old lady from Widnes had pressing all these buttons in this very posh hotel. And then they took us for tea at the Ritz. And she was enjoying herself as she would. She'd loved all this type of thing. She couldn't believe that she was doing these things. And she said to me, "David," she said, "behind you, don't look behind you. Look behind you." She said, "Who's that ugly man with Jerry Hall?"
"Oh, Mick Jagger."
"Oh, it's Mick Jagger." And of course, I'm looking like this. So we'd done all these things. And she said, "David, I'm exhausted now. And there's one last thing I'd like to do. And I wonder if we could do it together." And I said, "Yeah, well, I'd like to go to Goodison one last time." So I said, "Fine." So I wrote to, and this was in the day of fax machines.
Yeah.
So I faxed to Jim Greenwood, who I didn't know. I just said, "My mum's had a bit of bad luck and whatever. And she's really asked if you could do something special for her at Goodison." I got a fax back maybe an hour and a half later that all it said was, "Saturday, Arsenal, 12:30 players' entrance. Mm-hmm. See you there. You know, tell her not to bring her boots." That type of thing. And we went and we got there. And Gordon Watson, who became a Geordie, who became a lovely, you know, he'd been the coach, he'd won the league in 1938-39. He'd been the coach of Alan Ball and those people, Harry Cattick's coach. He was now serving as the tour guide.
Yeah.
They didn't really do tours in those days. So he met us and we did the tour. Of course, we had a few trophies to show back then. Yeah. We did the tour and I thought it was great. That's smashing. Yeah, I'm really pleased Everton had done this for my mum. And Gordon said, "Well, would you like to meet Howard?" Another Geordie.
Yeah.
You know, they were all clicked together, these people. So I said, "Yeah, of course it would." So we go to the dressing room, first team dressing room, game against Arsenal. And Howard came out to meet my mum, and she knew her name. My mum's name was Una, the unusual name, and Una. So he said, "David," he says, "you sit over there with Colin, and I'll take care of your mum." So I was thrilled sitting next to Colin Harvey, lovely guy, you know, hero. And my mum sat in the car and sit there, Una, and he then went about introducing all the lads to her. So Kevin Richardson wasn't playing, another Geordie. He wasn't playing that game, so he sat with her, I think maybe as an interpreter. Derek Mountfield came, Peter Reid came, Big Nev came, gave her a big hug and whatever. And they were all coming. And my mum could, you know, she knew about them. She could interact with them. She could engage them, and of course, you know, they were all quite pleased to, you know, to meet her.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Gary Stevens shows up, and Gary's a lovely lad. Look, yeah. You know, handsome-looking guy, athletic guy. He comes up, and they make way for him. He sits next to my mum, and they're all smiling. And my mum turns to Gary and says, "Gary says, how did you get the nickname Shaka Stevens?"
Wow.
And there was this roar of laughter.
Yeah.
And now, you know, others were poking their heads around. Graham Shapp was poking his head. What the hell's caused this roar of laughter?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they're all taking the mickey out of Gary.
Yeah.
So then it was a really uplift in what was going on. So she engaged with them for a little bit longer. And then Colin said, "It's time, you know, your mum got to go now. The boys want to take the clothes off." And I thought, well, we better not tell her that. You know, yeah, never get rid of it. So we, you know, I picked her up and off we go. And we'd gone through, I think Gordon Watson had taken us through out of the first team dressing room. And Colin, Howard came running behind us. He said, Ewan, there's one other thing, you know. And Kevin Sheedy was in tow.
Yeah.
And Kevin said to her, "Ewan," I said, "when I score today, your name is going to be on the ball."
Yeah.
Of course, he didn't score, but we won 6-1.
Yeah.
And for many years on, Howard used to say to me, "How was your mum?" You know.
Yeah.
He said, "You know, we should have got to there every game."
Yeah.
Because it really lifted the lad's spirits. You know, just a little bit of humour, and it takes away the tension.
Yeah. Don't know how we topped that one, but just finally, then. No, I mean, like you say, everyone thinks their own team is special, their own club is special, but you know, Goodison Park is unique, the first purpose-built football ground in English football, and staged the most top-flight matches of any ground. Hopefully, after it will be hosting Premier League football, we hope, next season for its final season. Just what is it you think you will miss the most about Goodison Park?
I've had, in my life, I've lived in 22 homes.
Yeah.
I've lived in 22 houses, but I've only ever had one home.
Yeah.
For me, Goodison has been many things. You know, when I couldn't read, it was like a sanctuary.
Yeah.
You know, I was treated as an equal. I was surrounded by friendship, camaraderie, compassion. I was tiny. People would always look after you.
Yeah.
And so really what I'm going to miss is going with us to the new ground. It's the fans.
Yeah.
They're special.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, from the young ones to the old ones, it's special. But I'll miss Goodison. Now, not knowing, you know, when's the last time I'll be at the match, I always pause. I think I upset the people behind me who were trying to get out. Before I get out, I always pause in the walkway and just take it all in, take a deep breath. And take it all in, and just look at it, and it is a spiritual type of place.
Yeah,
I think I'm very lucky to have enjoyed the time I've had at Goodison. The people I met, the players, the fans, the managers, etc. And it's been a great time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for a very special Goodison Park, my home, Dr. David France.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Royal Blue podcast from the Liverpool Echo.